You've heard it all your life, and not just from your mother, although you probably did hear it from your mother. You have such a great voice. Did you ever think of doing voiceover? Let's demystify this fun, flexible industry here on the VoiceOver Pod with Justine Reese, brought to you by Such a Voice. I'm Justine, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so, where we will talk to people that have sat in your shoes and then became successful in the voiceover industry. We'll talk to people who hire voiceover talent. We'll talk about recording, sound, auditioning, casting. We're going to share some stories. We're going to share some secrets. And then, who knows, you may be my next guest. And welcome to the VoiceOver Pod. We have a super exciting and very unusual guest today, Nikki Lanier. She is CEO of Harper Slade and a major voice in the DEI space. And we want to talk about voices in the DEI space. So welcome, Nikki. And please give us a little background on how you got to where you are to in this space. I met Nikki in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where she lives. There's an event coming up we're going to definitely talk about called the Rare Women's Collective, which is bringing white and Black women together in a space to talk about their voice in racism. So there's a lot of interesting things to touch on. So please introduce yourself with no further ado, and we'll get into it.
Yay, Justine, thank you so much for this opportunity. And I'm just so happy to be a part of any community you curate. From the second that we met, I thought, oh, this is fast friends and likely lifelong friends. I just love everything about your energy and your heart. So yes, thank you. Okay, so my work centers around race and equity and work and economics, right? So it's a pretty kind of interesting pairing. And I have found my voice, my perspective, the lens through which I see this work and practitioner in this space is informed by so many things. Like, so I started out practicing law in South Florida. I did labor and employment law for several years. And then I did human resources all over the place. I've worked for public sector, private, north side of the US, south side, east and west coast. I've worked for big companies and small, public and private. I don't know if I said that already. Yeah. I've been the chief HR officer for three different organizations, learned so much about how work works, when and where it restores, when and how it depletes, all the things, all the things about the power of the workplace. And then I worked for the Federal Reserve for 7 years and really started to delve into the macroeconomic implications of the cost of hate, the cost of exclusion, the cost of marginalization, at the macroeconomic level. And so, like, thinking about all of that and bridging all of that, I really wanted to offer inside of the DEI ecosystem a different angle for this perspective, blending employment law experience, HR experience, macroeconomic anchoring, and of course my lived experience. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, at a really high level, that doesn't just inform my professional pedigree and how I approach the work. It actually informs my voice, my lens, my perspectives on how I do this work.
Yeah. And have you seen or felt or noticed a change if we do get back to like hired voices in the corporate space, that there has been, you know, something that's kind of hard to talk about, at least for me. And I think what I love about you opening up the space to have difficult conversations where we don't know what to say sometimes. We don't know if it's okay to say, we're looking for a Black voice. And who's a Black voice? Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about this because in the same way that, you know, I'm Jewish and people talk about Jewish voices. Well, that's not a thing, but it is a thing to people. And that's usually like more of a New York sound, right? So what does it mean, do you think, when we talk about a Black voice?
Yeah. And I'll only speak, here's my caveat, I will only speak from Nikki's perspective. I dare not purport to speak on behalf of all Black people or Black women and the uniqueness of our voice. But there is a cadence, there is an intonation, mm-hmm. there is a sense of inflection and expression mm-hmm. that is born, I think, out of kind of some of the cultural dynamics that are true of how African-American Black people have navigated spaces and places, at least in the US. And I'm always really curious, Justine, this is like a whole other conversation, on how much of that is informed almost in utero, like from the ancestral realities that we just, many of us don't have much of by way of exposure to, but just like our cadence and our pentameter and our rhythms and the way that we speak and how expressive we are and all of that. And there's a different kind of depth, I think, to the Black voice. When you hear Black people talk, you can tell when, for the most part, you can tell when Black folks are talking, especially if it's Black folks talking to Black folks. Like if we're trying to assimilate another, then we, you know, we understand there's currency in white comfort with us. So many of us have kind of been taught and conditioned to kind of accentuate and differentiate our voices in various spaces. But when it is the authentic, very natural, effortless Black voice, that is its own kind of special nuance and idiosyncrasy that I think should be and absolutely is celebrated in artistry. The challenge though becomes when it's condemned and when it's indicted, right? And when it's assigned as a deficit voice, that becomes a problem.
And I know that I myself have used terminology out of just complete naivete, perhaps with students, where I might've said really naively, and I really do mean that. Like I've said something like, you've got an urban sound, and I have offended people by using that term, which to me meant like cool and hip. And it meant something else to, it's what I find interesting about voiceover in general is that we are taking words and bringing emotional tone to them, usually written by somebody else. So we have nothing else to bring to it but our own experience. And I always say to people in voiceover, what's going to book jobs, what's going to get you work is your authentic voice. Then you can layer in all the fun character stuff and you can get into character stuff. But at the end of the day, in messaging, that is what we are looking for. So when we get into this space of diversity in voices, what is something do you think that we can sort of like latch onto that feels okay, that feels right in the industry?
Yeah. The challenge is we have so much trauma that's informed. It is now informing how we are discerning interpretation of anything related to multiculturalism or cultures, races, whatever. So while on one hand, and I'm saying this, Justine, I mean, I don't dare compare myself to you because you are a consummate and amazing professional in voice. I've seen your work and it is phenomenal. I took a single voiceover class because somebody told me I had a nice voice. I thought it was cool. Anyway, I took a voiceover class. It was, I mean, I loved it. I didn't kill it, but you know. So I took this voiceover class and I had to like, there was like, I remember my instructor was like, okay, I need you to sound more like a Jewish mother. I need you to sound more like an African living in Paris who's trying to navigate how to get on the train. I need you to say, so there are realities to dialect.
Totally.
There's realities to like, and the challenge for us all though is to acknowledge the beauty and the importance and the cultural connections that come with acknowledging the differences in dialect without also assigning deficit.
Yeah.
And the marginalization and the diminishment of value. You don't sound acceptable. You don't sound educated. You don't sound as though you're someone who is well-read or well-spoken, when really the reality is I just don't sound like a white male heterosexual able body, whatever, right? I don't sound like the standard bearer. So therefore it's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's what I think we have. That's our unique challenge, I think, in the world, especially in the United States. And so it's not so much that we have to fight against, like, I wish that we could live in a world where you can say, Nikki, you sound like such a wonderful, beautiful Black woman, the way you speak, without me having to feel like, oh, am I supposed to take offense to that? What she mean by that? Is that an insult?
Right.
Is that a whole thing? But racism and all the isms have taught us that there's a possibility that the intention behind that is shrouded in some sort of indictment that now I have to figure out, okay, what does Justine mean? Let me figure out I know Justine bigger than that. She's in it, right? So it becomes this whole other thing that we have to manage. Racism taught us that as it relates to Black voices specifically.
Yeah, right. I think that's fascinating. I found this article and I kind of had shot it to you the last second about from a place called Market Messages, who employs voice talents. And great, I actually contacted the guy immediately and I said, I want to get you on the podcast because they do a lot of corporate IVR work. And they were saying, you know, that voiceover industry is asking itself these same tough questions that are happening in other areas of our corporate life, and that voices you know, voices carry, and that they wanted to build up their rosters with, you know, with more diversity. And I, you know, please speak a little bit about your work and what brought you to, and you have a fascinating history from your parenthood and your ancestry yourself. And yeah, what I think is so interesting about that, you know, you mentioned this in utero thing.
Yeah.
And frequently I will get a student, right? And I'll sense like some kind of accent, and I'll say, you know, where are you from? And they'll say, I'm from, you know, Kansas City. And I'll say, well, where are your parents from? And they'll say, oh yeah, the Philippines. And yeah, I'll say, did they speak a different language in the house? Because we pick up on that. And so there are subtleties and dialects that come in. And it used to be, you know, nothing that was hired was, you know, the male sort of neutral voice. Now we want diversity in the workplace. Women are, I think there has been studies done that sell products usually a little bit better than male voices. But I think in this diversity space, talk a little bit about your ancestry and, you know, affection on the voice. I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, well, let me just say this. You definitely want that dimension. You want that texture. You want that interesting flavor to how voices give life to product services and like all of the things that become currency for organizations. I think that I love that there's more organizations that are embracing that. Yeah. My particular story, so I said at the outset a little bit about kind of the, I don't know, the skills and the jobs that I've had that gave rise to what prepared me for the work that I do now in advancing racial equity with corporations across the globe. But what motivated me, Justine, what motivates me then, motivated me then to start and motivates me now, is really my lived experience in my childhood. So I am an only child, and I am born to two parents who were very, very steeped in the civil rights movement in the 60s, my father more violently so than my mother, but both of them, to be sure, had their own experiences with just the basics of trying to exercise Black life in an excellent way in the United States, and only being able to do so through a lens of permission, like whatever white America was prepared to dole out to them by way of their, what they felt was constitutionally appropriate, you know. And that's just kind of the life of all people, not all Black people, not just my parents. But because my dad, like when I grew up on a historically Black college campus, Hampton University, where I ultimately matriculated, my parents taught at Hampton University, so I'm from Hampton. And I grew up around an incredibly beautiful, academically potent, extraordinarily prolific, all these P's.
I love academics.
The P's are great. Like all these academics, Justine, that just sit around. My parents growing up, they just sat around and pontificated all the time about the plight of Black America. Like,
I mean, I don't want to interrupt, but I'm curious if that environment gave you like a bubble effect that you're like, everyone's living this life. Everyone's talking about this stuff, or not so much.
No, it didn't give me a bubble, but it gave me, I was very clear that this was unique. I wasn't clear how unique, but I was clear that it was unique because the way that my parents talked about the desire to feel the warmth of the Constitution and the elusive promise of the American dream, and the fact that Black people always, always, always had to fight for the right to exercise our rights without exception. I mean, that is without exception, even today. So I knew that there was some uniqueness that's just specific to the way that Black people have to move. But what I didn't have an appreciation for was the kind of academic orientation around how we talk about that, and the literature that my parents would cite, and the theorists that they would bring into their arguments. I mean, my mother was the chairperson of the English department, and she would literally, at our home, we would have people like Maya Angelou and Toni Cade Bambara and James Baldwin coming to our home.
Wow.
Because they were coming to speak on campus. My mother would have a dinner party for them. So like, these are the people that I engage with. And so I came out of my formative years, going into my collegiate years, really understanding, like, I am the bar. Right. Maybe that's arrogant, like, but I'm like, my parents set a very high standard, very high bar around my own elocution, my own understanding of worldliness, my own The insistence on being well-read and being well-spoken and understanding how to engage with audiences from a multitude of walks of life from a very young age, and then kind of being spat out of that into America's America, where everyone expected me to just be this poor Black kid from the ghetto. And I was, and I just, I'm not bemoaning that, I'm just saying that the narrative of Black is so singular in our country. Even today, it's so singular. And so the voice then that I've developed is an authentic one, is one that was nurtured since I was 7 years old. But I'm clear that it is also one that is met with my American comrades with some level of endearment. Some people find me, white people especially, find me interestingly articulate. A little bit of what, you know, they didn't, most don't expect by way of my heft, both by virtue of my pedigree and how I work. And so like, there's like a piece of that voice that I'm just so happy and honored to have owned. And that, to your point, like in utero, my grandmothers operated in this way. My parents operate in this way. I operate in this way. And I expect and have trained my children to operate with the fullness of all of it. Mm-hmm. All of it.
Yep. And I think it is these, to me, the backstories that we can come into spaces like voiceover, if you're going to be a voice of a book of fiction or nonfiction that maybe is dealing with this era. And I think, do you feel that there, you may not know the answer to this, but do you think that there's an intrigue of opposites? In other words, like, you know, utilizing a white voice for a perceived Black sort of product or a Black message, or opposite? Do you think there's, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that cultural, if that cultural marketing piece at all?
Kinda. I mean, only because I just remember a little bit from my own class, my coursework when I did my voiceover class, but also, as I share with you, my son is an artist, my son is an actor, and he's a classically trained actor. He performs in theaters, of course, on stages and in film, and watching him find voice for all of these characters that he has to give life to, and understanding the backstory and understanding the dimensions of the person that he's asked to become, and finding that voice, yes, not necessarily relying on his own, is something that, you know, he's familiar with his extended training. I kind of vaguely remember with my training, but also on some level, when you think about business as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. it is important that you seek your customer's voice, that you understand what they're burdened by and plagued with, and what vexes them, and what, you know, what needs need to be solved, what problems need to be solved, and what needs to be addressed per their lived experience, per their lens, per their voice. And speak to that in a way that's both authentic to you, but that reaches them.
I mean, I think that is the reason people tune into commercials if you're driving or something, because you feel somehow like, oh, that person's talking to me, which is something I always want to, for people who want to get into voiceover that still have this idea that it's about imitating or doing cool voices or crazy accents. That stuff can all come as long as you, number one, get in touch with the authentic voice, which in my opinion, helps us be better communicators, better speakers, better presenters, have better conversations. Who do you think, you already mentioned one of my heroes, Maya Angelou, but who do you think in the last 20 years have been voices of Black women that have really made a different kind of impact, besides yourself, of course, but.
Oh, I have two. Two, hands down, Oprah Winfrey.
Okay, of course.
Stylistically and substantively, she has changed the way that we have been taught to derive value, presumptive value from a Black woman speaking, mm-hmm. right? She's reset that fundamentally. The second, Michelle Obama.
No, it's so crazy. Those were the two people I was thinking of. That's crazy. That is crazy. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oh my God.
I believe that Michelle Obama she to me just reset the role of the first lady by having a very unique voice and not just delivering like what she was supposed to do, which I'm not saying that all other first ladies did that, but there was just something very different. And it wasn't just because she was Black, you know?
Yep. Oh, without a doubt. And I love that. And I love it because I love it as a Black woman because she was Black, because there was a sincerity and a candor and a authenticity and brilliance and intellect and temperance and wisdom and discernment and impeccable judgment. And what I will say, you know, this is a, I don't know how your viewers would take this or even what you think about this. Sometimes I worry that in a world like in our current dispensation and time, I feel like we have set such, we've been taught to devalue care for one another and being conscientious of being a steward over like your psyche. Like, I don't want to be authentic to the point where I'm trampling all over Justine. Mm-hmm. That's not authenticity. That's just being mean, right? And because we don't really place high premium anymore on critical thought and judgment and formulating good arguments, differentiating the person from the issue. Like, we don't place any value on that. We live in the clapback society, and you know, the best zinger wins, and we're just cutting down each other, mowing each other down in the name of authenticity, of finding my voice. This is my authentic self. And I'm just like eviscerating hearts and minds. Michelle Obama doesn't do that. Oprah doesn't do that. And that's not to say that they're not clear and true and real and unequivocal and, you know, clear-headed about standards and decorum. But there's a difference between that and just being rude and mean and unkind. And especially with Michelle Obama, who had every reason to be rude and mean and unkind, because people were being so rude and mean and unkind to her. She right. just never went there. So I just adore everything about her voice.
And
everything.
The way to, here's what's very interesting to me is, and I will say this, voiceover allows a space of permission in certain arenas to go there to be sarcastic. Sarcasm is, so I play a game in one of my classes called Emotional Charades, where we turn the camera off and everyone in the room has to guess the emotion through the voice that the voiceover artist is doing. And this is something I've taken into corporate too, because it's really fascinating, because it's very hard to sit down and go, well, what is sarcasm? And it really, when you get right down to it, when I give the coaching, make fun of somebody, nailed it, right?
Yeah.
But voiceover gives room and a place to get that stuff out in a way that actually might, you know, book a job, but it's a little bit of pretend. And it's interesting that it's used in marketing. Sarcasm is used in marketing all the time. And so it's just from a marketing perspective, emotional tone is really fascinating to me, and emotional tone in the same way it's emotional tone, the way Brené Brown talks about emotional mapping. That's how I like to talk about it in the voice. Another thing I was just sort of curious about is this event you have coming up that is bringing Brown, Black, White together, the Rare Women's Collective. Why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important? And what could someone expect to happen if they chose to come and join you?
Great question. Thank you so much. The Rare Woman Collective is a racial equity program suite that I have developed specifically for white women who are inclined, meaning interested in, curious about, want to know more around how to advance racial equity in every single space that you hold. It was birthed from two things. One is the understanding that in my company, Harper Slade, we do corporate facing work. We do amazing work in training and immersions and assessment and advisory works, corporate speeches and those kinds of things that really help move organizations into understanding, cultivating environments where Black and Brown talent can thrive. But it is a 9-to-5 endeavor, right? And so what I've noticed, as great as that work has been, after 5 o'clock, there's just very little opportunities for us to practice this concept of being racial equity stewards, of embracing this idea of how do I learn how to presumptively value Black and brown people in the same way that I presumptively value white after 5 o'clock, that we just don't live in a way where we can practice that. Most of us still live inside of segregation. So that's one thing. The second thing is, as you mentioned at the top of our discussion, I do live in Louisville, Kentucky, where Breonna Taylor was killed in 2020. I was here helping the city, as many of us were, navigating all of that and all of the pain and the anguish of that. And I had a number of white women come to me saying, how can I help? What can I do? And I sidelined them, if I'm honest. I mean, it was just like, I don't know, I'm busy. I'm freaking out. I can't deal. And so white women were just kind of like, well, I guess I'll figure out something. Maybe I'll read a book or start a book club or something, right? And so it's not intuitive. What I want us to all understand is this idea of racial equity is not at all how we've lived, how we've been conditioned to think. Right. We have no training around this. We have no exposure to what specifically happened to Black and brown people as we are like bemoaning CRT. We don't want to talk about it. We don't teach it. We don't learn about it in our schools. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all we know for the most part, the general we Americans know is that like Black people are always asking for something that they don't deserve, always like living subpar because they just aren't highly intellectual, like all these things, right? That's the natural place for us to land unless we claw our way out of that. So what I also know because of my work with the Fed is that by 2045, we'll have a Blacker and browner America. And we're gonna be relying on the very community, Black people and brown people, to sustain our economy. That's also the same community that has only known marginalization based on race. And so I'm like, okay, we need an after 5 o'clock solution. And we got all these white women are like, hi, remember me from 2020? I'm still up in here, help me, right?
You know, it's funny. I remember when it happened, and because I have this connection to Louisville, when I heard about Breonna Taylor, I just felt this instant guttural. Mm. Let me get out and march. It was the first like march I attended, and holding a sign. But I also had my white friends going, "Don't expect those Black women to explain this to you. That's not their job." And then I'm like, "Okay, well, but what if I really don't know? I mean, yes, I'll go read." I mean, you know, all the movies were coming out on Netflix, like, here's your BLM, you know, watch these movies, listen to these podcasts. And we were doing our best, but I think that I'm glad you're doing this because it is a space of, all we have is fear around it. Every time I say, you know, and some of our, James Seawood is used to be one of our teachers, and he's one of our prime examples of a successful Black voice that is just killing it in voiceover right now and working for everybody. Buffalo Wild Wings, you know, he's got this deep, resonant, deep voice, but I just felt like, well, then what do I do if I can't ask my Black friends? Is it okay to say Black? Is it okay to say brown? And I love that even right on your website, you put that out there because we don't know, literally.
We don't. And let me tell you, and Black women get mad at white women for not knowing. And then we get mad at you for asking us, right? Because we know it well. We know racism well. We know white racism well. We know how white racism shows up in our lives. Mm-hmm. And we've had to figure out how to navigate it and somehow have built up, and I guess it's understandable, built up this kind of calcified resentment for feeling like it's now my responsibility to teach you how to not be racist against me.
Yeah.
However, I don't see it that way at all. I see it because we have this urgency around amplifying our economic well-being, because we absolutely do need this social justice, because I see the absence of racial equity by 2045 as a national security threat. Mm-hmm. I think our best bet is white women, to be frank, teaching white women how to become racial equity operatives. Why? Because you've got the one thing that I will never have, and that is proximity to white men, who on the topic of racial equity must be moved. I can't, even with all my pedigree, all my experience, all my speaking engagements, whatever, I just can't reach your family, your spouse, your children, your loved ones in a way that you can. So I wanna teach you how to do it. And that's what the Rare Woman Collective is about. So it's a movement. It is a live event that launches November 2nd through 4th here in Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And it's a set of coaching experiences and retreats and practice sessions and a community of white women who are coming from all over the country saying, I want to do this work with Nikki and her team. Teach me and deploy me.
Yeah, I love it. Feel free to reach out. We will list your how to reach you here and try and get this up and running as quickly as possible. And tell us, where is the best way to reach out to you? I know Rare Women's Collective has its own website. And if you're not in the area, there's not going to be a hybrid for this event, but right. There may be other things that people could reach out to you for some sort of a virtual experience potentially. Yep.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So we'll have a post Rare kind of virtual set of experience, several experiences to come. So just, I would encourage people, my entire marketing department is social media. So if you've reach out to me on LinkedIn, on Facebook, especially TikTok. TikTok okay. is like where I have most of my followers, oddly.
So interesting. Okay. We're just trying to expand into that. TikTok.
I didn't think it was going to work. It's been quite a blessing. So anyway, so we have like communities that are formulating in each of these kind of pockets of social media, and we'll continue to pump out information on how to stay involved with the Rare Woman Collective as a white woman, how to advance racial equity, how we can help you advance racial equity corporately. We also have coaching programs for Black women who are trying to navigate corporate spaces and needing for some more support. And coaching, ripening and respite as they're moving through those spaces that are often unfamiliar, just didn't contemplate the way that we show up. So there are a lot of ways for us to think about cracking this ever elusive racial equity nut. And so we wanna make sure that we are a part of helping to advance and support whomever might be inclined.
Fantastic. And I just wanna say to listeners as well, as a voiceover artist and someone who trains voiceover artists and somebody who really knows what's getting cast out in the world, there is so much room for diversity. This is a wonderful at-home side hustle career for those of you who are maybe, you know, one of my biggest gifts or one of my biggest missions is to empower all women, especially later in life, in retirement, empty nesting, wanting to do something creative. This is a door like the wardrobe in Narnia, I like to say, and it will take you so many places. And to be able to cross these boundaries and bridge these gaps. There's much room for work and workforce in Black, brown, and white women. So I hear to that. And I'm very excited. I'll be there at the event. I believe I even did a little voiceover for you.
You absolutely did. Thank God. Yeah, you will be the opening voice that everyone hears.
There you go. I'm very excited about that. Yeah. I can't wait. So if you want more information about voiceover, you guys know how to reach me, Justine at Such a Voice. Nikki, what's a quick shot? LinkedIn, I know you're on all the socials. What's the best way to get to you?
Yeah, probably TikTok or admin@NikkiLanier.com. That's my email straight to me. We get to whatever company or track you want to be focused on. We can get there using that email.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for talking today about diverse voices in this industry and in this world. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you want to learn more about what it takes to become a working voiceover actor, come to an intro class or schedule a voice evaluation with Justine. You can contact her at justinereese@suchavoice.com. That's JustinReiss at suchavoice.com. Or check out our website at suchavoice.com. If you like the podcast, subscribe to this channel or leave a review. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.